All right, so we are recording. This is Bio 160, March 2007. And it's the 15th of March, even. Oh, it's a memorable day for, who, Augustus Caesar? Okay. Wasn't today when he got... Okay, any questions? Oh, the organs of the central nervous system. How about brain stem, cerebrum, and cerebellum?
What about brain and spinal cord?
Brain and spinal cord is two. I like brain and spinal cord, but if there's only two, but you said three, right? Well, if you give me three choices and you say brain, I'd say cerebellum, cerebrum, and brain stem. But if you say central nervous system and you give me two choices, I would say brain and spinal cord.
It does say organs of the central nervous system.
It does say central nervous. I wonder if that's a misprint. But there's only two, huh?
It should just be two,
brain and spinal cord. Yes, ma'am. Right. Okay. Any other questions? You know what? I think you're scheduled for a test on Tuesday.
What?
Test on Tuesday. And it's going to be on what? Muscles, nerves, and sensation, which is what we're going to cover today. Yes. And in particular, special sensation. You do have a take-home quiz that will help you prepare for the test on Tuesday. So I would hope to see a lot of students during office hours or something, making sure that your study guides are filled in correctly. I would be happy to do that. All right. If you don't have time to come in and see me, you can still get the discussion in an audio format in the reserve section of the library. Just ask for the Bio 160 CD. And they'll be there. And the nice thing about a CD is what? You don't have to wind through it like a tape. You can just have random access. You can just hop from one point to another very quickly to find the information you want. And usually it works pretty well. All right, so we were working on some questions. Probably, let's pick up on question number 15. Identify four lobes of the cerebral cortex. The four lobes starting from the anterior part of your head. Frontal, and then posterior to that is
parietal,
and then posterior to that is
occipital,
and then way down on the sides and maybe a little bit anterior are the temporal lobes. So frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal here and here. That's number 15. Parietal. And then the functions of the lobes. All right, if I'm going to simplify... functions of the lobe. Frontal lobe is motor, movement. Higher functions of reasoning, that's important. I don't know if I would pick on that one. I think I might pick on motor, motion. All right, then parietal would be, sensation, somatic sensation, like pain and pressure, temperature, tickling. All right, for parietal lobe. Occipital lobe would be vision. And then, we're on 15. Know the functions of the lobes. So first we wrote down what lobes, and then we're giving some general descriptions. And then temporal lobe, if I were to pick one, I would probably say that's where your primary auditory cortex is for hearing. So I'd say hearing. In temporal lobe, temporal lobe. Those are good. Yes, it's true, they do other things, but let's just keep it simple like that. Okay? Be able to identify the cerebellum and give its function. The cerebellum is inferior to the occipital lobe, and it has a different look to it. It has very tightly spaced convolutions. They kind of just look like ribs, not big folds. And the cerebellum is important for control of, muscle control for balance, so that you can keep your equilibrium. Where is the spinal cord? Well, it's from the foramen magnum, and so it's underneath the brain. It's in the vertebral column, and it goes all the way down to, I think, L1. I like L1. Okay, so you don't really have spinal cord below L1 like at L2. That's why we say that's a good place for... Did I say L2? Well, it's close. Okay. I would never say L1, L2, L1 and a half. Okay. Below the level of L2 would be prime spots for... For getting cerebral spinal fluid. For getting like a lumbar tap. Let's see. Spinal cord. Oh, and is it part of the central nervous system? Sure is. What are the pathways entering and leaving the spinal cord? Uh-oh. I don't know if I know those. The pathways entering or leaving. Those would be the roots. Right? And the pathway that's leaving, that's motor, that would be the ventral root. Ventral root is leaving. And the root that's entering is sensory, bringing information to your central nervous system. That would be the dorsal. Yeah, the dorsal root. Sensory is dorsal. That's entering your CNS. Which root is motor, which is sensory? Oh, we did that already. I got carried away. All right. What is a reflex? Know the parts of a reflex arc. What the heck does a reflex do? It allows you to respond to, some kind of painful stimulus or obnoxious or noxious stimuli, painful stimuli. And the spinal cord makes a decision in what to do before it even gets to the brain. Because by the time those signals get to the brain, maybe a lot of damage has been done to your body already. So the reflex arc just involves your spinal cord. So it's very fast and you don't even have perception of what's happening because those signals have to reach your brain before you consciously know what's going on. So what are the parts? Let's see if I can figure out what the parts. A reflex arc always, let's say what it starts with and what it ends with. It always starts with a stimulus and it always ends with a response. All right, so it starts with a stimulus, ends with a response. So now we've got to fill in the pieces in the middle. So you got stimulus. What can pick up a stimulus? It's got to be a receptor. Okay, so you got stimulus, receptor, and then the receptor sends a signal through a sensory neuron to the central nervous system. And it's got to go through the dorsal root ganglia there into the central nervous system where it excites an interneuron, and that interneuron makes a decision on what to do with that information. It sends it up to your brain so you can perceive what's going on. But it also tells a muscle to do something, right? And when it tells a muscle to do something, it's going to stimulate a motor neuron. So you got what? Stimulus, receptor, sensory neuron, interneuron, then motor neuron. That motor neuron goes to an effector organ, which is going to produce some kind of response. So those are all the pieces of a reflex arc. In that order. That's in your notes. Okay. If you include the dorsal root ganglia, it's a little bit more, but the basic one has got those five parts to it. Okay? I think I embellished it just a little bit because I didn't want you to forget about the dorsal root ganglia. Okay. What are the three layers of the meninges? Where do you find the meninges? The meninges, around the brain and spinal cord. They're all around the central nervous system. And the most superficial layer. Yeah, it says list them. Okay, let's list them from superficial to deep. Superficial is the dura, which is the durable layer. I like that. Okay. And then the middle one is the arachnoid. Arachnoid. And then the deepest one is the pia mater. Pia mater, and that's very, very delicate and weak, and it just follows every little fold on the brain. And where is the cerebral spinal fluid found, or CSF? CSF is cerebral spinal fluid. Where do you find it? between the pia and the arachnoid, and that is also called then the subarachnoid space. Yeah. So you could say between the arachnoid and the pia, that would be the same thing, subarachnoid space. Okay, what do somatic voluntary nerves innervate? Somatic, and I'm being redundant there. That's like saying military, no, that's not right. I was going to say military intelligence. That's opposite terms. These are the same terms. Somatic and voluntary are the same terms. What do they innervate? What do you have voluntary control over? Skeletal muscle. Okay, skeletal muscle. What do autonomic nerves innervate? Cardiac, smooth, and glands. Right? Because those you don't have direct control over. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. How many cranial nerves are there? There's 12. And where do they come from? They come from your cranium, so therefore they're called cranial nerves. They come from your brain. All right, and you should know the name and the function of cranial nerves 1, 2, 3, and 10. 10 is the vagus. What does it do? Just pick one thing. You could find a big list of what it does, but it inhibits the heart. It slows the heart rate. Cranial nerve number 10, the vagus, slows the heart rate. Okay? Should we go backwards or should we start at the beginning? Okay, cranial nerve number 1.
Olfactory.
Ooh, I almost said that wrong. You're right. Olfactory. Yeah, olfactory for smell. Number 2. Optic. That's for vision. So that's purely sensory as well. So number 1 is sensory, smell. Number 2 is sensory, vision. Number 3 is oculomotor. That helps move your eyeballs around. Even without turning your head, you can look right, look left. What movie is that from? Look right, look left, but don't drive angry. That's what Groundhog Day, when he's trying to teach a groundhog how to drive the car. Okay. Yeah. Okay, oculomotor is to move your eyeball around. What are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? Or is there only one? No, there's two. There are two. What are they? They're antagonistic to each other. There's parasympathetic and sympathetic. Oh, I gave away the next answer. Are the divisions synergistic or antagonistic? They're antagonistic. That's right. Yes. All right. And is that a good thing? Yeah. Very good thing. Precise control and balance. Give an example of a primary neurotransmitter for the sympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic. Sympathetic is fight or flight. That would be norepinephrine. Yeah, norepinephrine. Fight or flight. And then the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and repose nervous system is? Yeah, acetylcholine. I'm probably teaching you how to pronounce it wrong. I say acetylcholine, but most people say acetylcholine. You say acetylcholine? Okay. Either way. And which division is responsible for the flight or fight response? The sympathetic. That's what, it's going to keep you awake and your heart beating and your eyes dilated and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's it for nervous system, unless somebody's got a question on nervous system. So now, without any further ado, we start senses. Okay, say that again. Have you had a quiz? No. You got a quiz on 9, I think, today, and then you have a take-home on 10 for the weekend to help you prepare for the test. Okay, so you got two quizzes coming up. Yeah, it was a little short, so I made that one a take-home. Okay, oops. No, I think that was me. Okay, general versus special senses. You should have in your mind the distinction between general and special. All right, but first, let me tell you the names of some. Pain, temperature, touch, pressure. These are general senses. And then there's a sense of position. right? And we call that proprioception. And it's not just general position of like where you're sitting in the room, but what kind of configuration your body is in. Like you have your hand above your head, or you have your arms out in front of you. Even with your eyes closed, you know about where all the various pieces of your body are, right? And that's because there are receptors all over your body that tell you what the angulation of joints are, what the tensions of muscle are in various parts of your body, and we call that proprioception. So that seems like kind of a special sense, but it's not a special sense. That's a general sense. And let me tell you what the special senses are. Olfaction, taste, vision, hearing, and balance. All right, now, who knows what olfaction means? Olfaction is? I'm tricking you. Even though I'm leaning forward trying to listen, it's not hearing. Olfaction is smell, the sense of smell. And taste, we know, vision. All right, hearing is not olfaction. I thought I was going to trick somebody. Okay. Now, why are those special compared to these over here are general? Even proprioception is general. This is true. Because for a general sense, you have those receptors all over your body. You have temperature receptors all over your body. If I took an ice cube and put it on the tip of your nose, you could feel it. If I put it on your elbow, you could feel it. Or on your back, you could feel it. So you have temperature receptors everywhere. And the same thing for pain and touch, pressure, position, and proprioception, you have sensors all over your body. You know what every limb is doing, what every finger is doing, every part of your body. But the special senses, you rely on just a very simple, well, actually just a very small localized part of your body. For instance, vision. You have two specialized organs on your anterior face that allow you to perceive light. Right, you can't perceive light from your belly button or from the back of your elbow or whatever, or your fingertips. All right? So special just means it is specially localized to some part of your body. And the same thing for taste. You can't taste with your fingertips. You can only taste with your tongue. And hearing, you can only hear with your ear. You can't hear with your toes. All right? So that's what makes special different from general sensation. All right, so let's talk about olfaction. Olfaction is that sense of smell. And how does that work? Let me see if I have some kind of slide that talks about olfaction. All right, what's a body region that you use for smell? Nose, right? Okay, so where the heck is that nose at? Maybe I don't have a nose. Ah. Here's the nose. Okay, so here's the nose. Here's a nasal cavity. And in the superior, it's an awfully small picture, but in the superior part of the nasal, and here's your mouth right here. Superior part of the nasal cavity, there's a bone in your cranium that has a bunch of holes in it, and you have a bunch of olfactory nerves that go through those holes, those foramina, and these nerves have receptors to what we call odorant molecules, molecules that have a certain kind of shape to them that will bind to a receptor on these cells right here. And when those odorant molecules bind to receptors on these olfactory nerves, they cause a depolarization. And if that depolarization is sufficient, then it's going to cause an action potential to go to the brain. So when I say depolarization, what are you thinking about? How about an ion? Sodium. And then what kind of direction was happening to that ion? It's moving into the cell. So when sodium moves into the cell, that's an electrical event that we call depolarization. And if it's sufficient, then it's going to cause an action potential that's going to go to the brain, and as a matter of fact, to the olfactory cortex, and you're going to have the perception of smell. And here is that bone. This is the ethmoid bone. You don't have to know that. You don't have to know the name of those holes, but here you can see all those nerve cells that are down, just dangling in your nasal cavity. They're surrounded by mucus that helps trap odorant molecules, but this is the only place in your whole body where you actually have nerves just dangling out in space outside your body, because your nasal cavity is what? Really outside your body. But because they're just in air surrounded by mucus, they don't live very long. And they die pretty quickly, but then they're reproduced because there's stem cells over here that grow them back again. And that's really interesting, because that's really the only nerve cell I know that can regenerate. So I guess if somebody wants to find nerve cells or stem cells to rebuild the spinal cord, maybe I would look at these cells right here for smell to see if you could regenerate spinal cord nerve cells. All right, so where does that go? So airborne molecules called odorants or odors bind to receptors on those nerve cells, and that initiates action potentials in olfactory nerves. And what cranial nerve is that? Cranial nerve number one, and that sends signals to the, well, temporal lobe, for instance. All right, so that you can perceive the sense of smell. Okay. Taste. Let's talk about taste. Your tongue is important for taste. You have taste buds on your tongue, and it follows the same kind of motif. You have to have a molecule binding to a receptor on a taste bud. And when it binds to that receptor, it's going to cause depolarization of that cell, which is going to set up an action potential, and that's going to be sent to your brain. All right, and I have the cranial nerves right here that do that, but you don't have to know these cranial nerves, because I'm going to only ask you what? The first three and then number 10. So you don't have to learn these, but if you're interested, you could go ahead and memorize those. You have four primary taste sensations. There's some recent discussion if this is really true or not. Some people are finding a lot of exceptions to these rules, but that's what rules are for, so I think I'm just going to go ahead and tell you. All right, these primary taste sensations are sour, salty, bitter, and sweet. All right, and on your tongue, we can kind of map this out. Sweet is on the tip of your tongue, all right, and bitter, sour is going to be more at the posterior part of your tongue, and salty somewhere in between. So maybe you could try this at home, get some sugar or some sugar water and put it on your tongue in various locations and see where you can perceive that sweet taste. If you put it all the way in the back of your mouth, I bet you don't taste it. But if you put it on the tip or maybe a little bit on the side of your tongue over here, you'll taste it. And then these less pleasant kinds of taste, you'll find way in the back of your mouth, and probably because the things that taste bitter or sour are harmful for you to eat. And it would be really hard to eat something without it passing over, what, that part of the tongue. But if it was on the tip of your tongue and you were to eat something nasty, you could do what? Like, you could, like medication, you could like put it in the back of your mouth and swallow it and without tasting it. But not so if there are those receptors back over there. Okay, so on your tongue, you see things that commonly referred to are taste buds, but they're not really taste buds. Those are papillae. These are large structures, and around all of these papillae are your taste buds. So here is a taste bud with a bunch of taste cells, and if that molecule binds to a receptor right here, it's going to start an action potential down these sensory nerves. All right, so that's it for olfaction and for taste. So let's move on to vision. So what kind of senses are these? Special senses. That's right. All right, vision has some accessory structures associated with it. All right, as well as photoreceptors for light. But it's got some accessory structures. For instance, like your eyebrows, your eyelids, your, oh, look, I left off what? I should have eyebrows and eyelashes, right? Little hair. And what do these things do? They just prevent or help prevent foreign bodies from falling into your eye. Okay, so it keeps a lot of debris out of your eye. And your eyelids, the same thing. It keeps debris out of your eye, but it also helps moisten your eye so it doesn't turn into a potato chip. And there is a membrane that surrounds the eye and the inside layer of your eyelids. That's called the conjunctiva or conjunctiva. That's a nice wet membrane. All right. What's that called when you get an infection of that membrane? Pink eye or conjunctivitis. Okay, and a lacrimal gland, guess what that does? It produces tears, and tears, there's a little piece on the medial part of your eyelids, right over here, and it's called a carnuncle. And a sty is an infection of that carnuncle. So it's a little bit different than pink eye. And conjunctivitis, I don't know if it's primarily viral or bacterial. I think it's primarily viral. You can't get it, but it's very contagious. That sty, I think, is primarily bacterial, and I don't really know how infectious it is. Okay, so that could happen. Okay, so let's maybe see where some of these structures are. Can I see where some of these things are? Yeah, good enough. Here's an eyebrow, your eyelids, all right, your eyelashes. Your lacrimal gland is superior to your eye, but lateral, and it produces tears that bathe your eyeball, keep it from drying out, and it washes out debris and bacteria, which then drain into these superior and inferior caniculi, into the lacrimal sac, and then the lacrimal sac drains down into the lacrimal duct into your nose, into your nasal cavities. That's why you get a runny nose whenever you're teary-eyed, right? Because your tears just run, if they don't run down your face, they run through these structures right here into your nose. All right, there's some other accessory structures with the eye, and we call these extrinsic eye muscles. And we've got six of them. I'm not going to ask you to label these on a diagram, but you should just know that if here is an eyeball or globe, it has various muscles associated with it that can turn it around. The eyeball can look up, can look down, can look to the side or in any direction and without even turning your head, because you have the best vision in one part of your eye. It's almost the posterior part of your eye. So if you want to look to the right, you want to put that posterior part of your eye on that object, and to do that, you use those muscles, right, to just focus light from that direction right on the posterior part of the globe over there. That's called the macula lutea, and the very center of that is the fovea centralis. You might have a diagram of that. Okay, and that gives you your best vision. So these extrinsic eye muscles, and these are skeletal muscles. You have voluntary control of where you want to look. Okay. All right, now about as far as the eye is concerned, some of the optical components of the eye. Here's a list, and I'm just going to put a nice diagram up and talk about some of this stuff. All right, here's a good diagram. Well, before I get to that diagram, maybe I want to show you this diagram right here. Okay, so does this drawing, is this person have his eyes open or closed? Closed, because you see what? You see the eyelid here and eyelid here. The eyelids are approximated, so they're closed. And you can see the eyelashes right there. Here's the conjunctiva, that membrane. It doesn't go over this part of the eye, but it goes over the white of your eye and also the inner lining of this eyelid right here. Okay. All right. So let's take that off, and then let's look at an eyeball itself. Here we go. Okay. Very nice structure. First, let's talk about layers of the eye. So here are, and I think this is an exam figure. Ooh. It's really important, so probably you would see this on the test on Tuesday. So let's look over this. First, the layers that make up the globe itself, there are three of them. The most superficial is called the sclera, and it kind of looks white, and it's very leathery. It's tough. It's even probably harder than an eggshell. If you want to cut through it, you need a really sharp instrument. A pair of scissors probably won't even do it. Like if you want to cut your shoes, you know, probably scissors wouldn't do it. Same thing for the sclera. It's very tough. And it maintains the shape of the eye. And, of course, then it protects the eye because it's real tough. Very leathery. The next layer is called the choroid. Here it is. Choroid right here. I wish I could zoom in. It's that darker region. And hopefully it's red. Is it red? It's too small to tell probably, huh? Okay, because the choroid has got blood vessels in it. That's the part that's nourishing the sclera, and it's also nourishing this inner layer right here, which is what we call the retina. So the layers from superficial to deep are sclera, choroid, and retina. And the important thing about the retina is that it has the photoreceptor cells. Those are the cells that you can actually perceive light with. So that's very important. Here it is. We said the most important part of the eye for seeing things in high resolution, fine detail, and color is the macula lutea, which is about in this region right here, and in the very center of that is the fovea centralis. So fovea centralis you might want, okay, and that's directly opposite the lens and the cornea, so light is going to come right in and hit this object right here. So if you want to look right or left to see what's right or left, you have to turn your eye so that light hits just this area right here. All right, the nerve that takes information from the photoreceptors to your brain is the optic nerve right here. Okay, and in this part of the retina right here, we call that the optic disc, and it's got actually a common name. Anybody know what the common name for this is? And it's not too common, but it's a little common, and it is called the blind spot. Because in this area of the retina here, you have photoreceptor cells. But in this region of the retina, what do you got? You've got the optic nerve right there, which means you don't have any photoreceptors. So in that part of the eye, guess what? You can't see anything. There's absolutely no way because it doesn't have photoreceptors. So right now, as you're watching me, you have a blind spot in one eye and you got a blind spot in the other eye. Who can see those blind spots? You can't, right? And you think I'm fooling you. Okay, you're trying to find it, but your brain is so good. Yes, okay. I can actually show you a diagram. We can trick your mind to see that blind spot after class if you want. I'll put a little diagram on the board, and I'll show you how to do it, and then I'll make a mark on the board, and if we position you just right, that mark is going to disappear. Okay, but you can only use one eye at a time, because if you use both eyes, your brain is going to say, hey, that mark is really there, and it's going to put it in your illusion of vision, and you're going to see it. But if you just use one eye, your brain can't trick you into seeing it because it's not there. Okay, so we'll look at that blind spot. So in order for you to see, you need what? Those photoreceptor cells in the retina, and if they're covered up, right, you're going to have a blind spot. Okay. All right, so this part of the eye right here, this is what we call the posterior cavity, right? This is anterior, here's posterior. This is the posterior cavity. And it's filled with a substance that helps maintain the shape of the eye, and it's also very clear, so light can get from the cornea all the way through it to get to the retina. And that's called vitreous humor. Vitreous humor is like a jelly substance. It's very viscous. And I don't know, it's just like jello. Jello substance, but it's clear. I never tasted it to know what it tastes like. Probably doesn't taste like jello. Okay. All right, but it's clear. So we find that in this posterior cavity right over here. The next thing we got is a lens. Right, and you can see it actually kind of looks like a lens. And everything in front of the lens is what we call the anterior cavity. And in that anterior cavity, we don't have vitreous humor. We got something called aqueous humor. What do you think the nature of aqueous humor is like? Is it like jelly or jello? It should be more like water, right? Aqueous humor is just like water. Okay, aqueous. So here is a watery substance, and here is a jello-like substance. Furthermore, this anterior cavity is broken up into two other little chambers. Here is the iris, here and here, and there's an aqueous humor in front of it. We call that the anterior chamber, and there's aqueous humor behind it. We call that the posterior chamber. Okay. Now, the iris right here, what does the iris do? It can constrict, all right? And when it does that, what happens to the pupil? The pupil gets really small. Or the iris can dilate and the pupil can get really big. And so the pupil right here really isn't a structure. The pupil is just a hole in the iris. And that size of that hole is determined by the state of constriction of the iris. So if it's really dark outside, guess what happens to the iris? It dilates, the pupil gets bigger, and it just lets more light into the eye so that you can see stuff. But when it's really bright, for instance, if I were to look into this projector lamp right here, what would happen to my pupils? They'd go bam, they'd shrink down, right? And that would help protect my eye from excessive light. So the iris just adjusts the amount of light that can either enter or exit the eye. That's its job. Okay. The cornea is a part of the sclera, but it's a special part of the sclera. It's not white, right? It's clear. And because it changes its nature, it's no longer very strong. It's clear and it's pretty delicate and it has a lot of nerve fibers. Has anyone ever damaged their cornea by maybe leaving their contact lenses in overnight or getting some dirt between a contact lens and their cornea? You know what? I've never damaged my cornea, which is really a good thing, because they say that those nerve fibers right there give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience. Okay, more so than childbirth, more so than kidney stones or any other kind of pain. So it's always recommended that you protect your eyes from that exquisite sense of pain. And as a matter of fact, I've only known one person to leave their contact lenses in overnight, the hard contact lenses in, more than one time. It's so painful, you'll remember it for the rest of your life and you'll never do it no matter what, except for that one person. You can probably imagine what that one person was like. Okay, huh? It wasn't me. Okay, because I don't wear contacts. Okay. Okay, but that's not the bad thing about damaging your cornea. Okay, maybe you damage the cornea. Maybe you're putting together a bicycle or a swing set for your kids or something, and a screw flies away or a wrench breaks or something and it hits you in the eye and you're not wearing glasses or goggles. Or you're messing around in laboratory and something flies into your eye, it hits the cornea and it rips the cornea. It's going to feel real bad, but that's not the bad thing. Here's the bad thing. When you have a hole in your cornea, what's going to happen to that aqueous humor? It's just going to dribble right out of your eye. Okay? And then you're going to have a mess on your eye. It's not a whole lot of fluid. That's not the bad thing. But so here's the bad thing. When the aqueous humor leaves your eye, guess what? There's nothing separating the cornea from the iris. And there's nothing separating the iris from the lens right here. Right? And the cornea can touch the iris. Now, what can you tell me about the iris? Does it just sit there all day long? No, it's moving around all the time, right? I'm looking around right now, my iris is moving. But when the cornea touches the iris just like that, these things are sticky inside there and they get stuck together. So the iris now is glued to the cornea and no one has ever figured out a way how to unglue it. So it's glued together for the rest of your life. And what should that iris be doing all the time? Moving around. But now it can't. So you have a severe vision deficit as a result of that. Okay. So just, huh? They can't, yeah, it's the aqueous humor is going to refill that compartment, but those structures are just going to be stuck together. And your eye is going to look weird, right? Because instead of having a nice round iris, it's going to be all mottled and stuck together. And it's going to look weird, and your vision is really going to be screwed up as a result of that. All right, something else happens. Not only is the cornea and iris sticky when put together, but the iris and the lens is sticky when it gets stuck together. Okay, and the lens right here, the job of the lens is also to change shape to allow you to see structures up close. We call that accommodation. So again, your vision gets really screwed up because a lot of things inside the eye are designed to what? Move around, and when they all get glued together, they can't move around anymore, and you might not be able to focus, or you might not be able to see in bright light or dim light. It's just really a mess. So It's really a good idea for everybody to go out and buy a pair of glasses this afternoon and wear glasses to protect your eyes. Okay? It's a good idea. I think I'm nuts. Just even clear glasses would protect you. But for sure, if you're ever going to do any kind of mechanical work, wear goggles, because it's just split seconds, okay, that could hurt your eye and you could lose your vision in that eye. That's why they say, you know, if you're doing any working in the wood shop or auto shop or anything like that, protect your eye. Doing any welding, my goodness. Okay. Any kind of dangerous work like that. Okay. Well, so, Okay, this aqueous humor is being produced by something, and if that fluid is produced too rapidly, then it produces a high pressure inside this anterior cavity. And that high pressure then gets transmitted back to the retina, and it can block some of the blood vessels that are bringing oxygen to the retina. And that condition is called glaucoma. Okay, and when you have too high a pressure in the anterior cavity right here, that also will hurt your vision in the long run and probably could produce blindness. So glaucoma. And whenever you get your eyes tested, okay, they test for glaucoma to see what the pressure is. Does anybody know how they do that? It's kind of obnoxious. It doesn't really hurt. That's with the air. So that's what they do these days. They have this little blast of air, and so they go poof, right on the cornea right here, and then they watch and see how the cornea vibrates back and forth. And if it vibrates, if it hardly dimples at all and vibrates real fast, then there's too much pressure. But if they do the poof of air and it goes way in your head and comes back out slowly, then you have the right amount of pressure. Okay, so that's how they figure out the amount of pressure in there. Just like if you have a tire full of high pressure, if you poke it with your thumb, you can't push your thumb in there, but if it's low, well, bicycle tire anyway, what you can make a little dimple in it. Same thing with your cornea right here, with that pressure of the aqueous humor. Okay. Let's take a look at this list right here. Anterior compartment, got it. Aqueous humor, cornea, iris, pupil, lens. I didn't talk about this guy and this guy yet. The posterior compartment, vitreous humor, sclerochoroid retina. We're good except for some of the cells and the optic nerve. We're good except for a couple things. We said that this lens can change shape. Changing the shape of the lens is real important because you can change where you're going to focus your attention. You can do a near point focus or you can do a far point focus. So for instance, stick your hand out in front of you and look at your fingertips. Right, and get them in focus. All right, now what about the objects behind your fingertip? Are they in focus or out of focus? They're out of focus. You can't get both in focus at the same time. And if you keep your fingers there and then focus behind them, what do your fingers look like? They're out of focus. They're out of focus. Right, you'd see like 20 or 30 fingers. Like that, because the shape of your eye changes, but also the shape of the lens. When you're younger, for instance, this lens can change shape a lot more easily. It's more elastic, it's more pliable. But as you get older, these cells here are the same cells. They get older too, and the lens gets harder. It's harder to change its shape. And then you can't see things up close. And the process of focusing up close from far away is what we call accommodation. So that's important. That's on your list right here. Okay, so accommodation is due to the movement of the lens. And there's a muscle inside your eye. The ciliary body right here is a muscle that pulls on these suspensory ligaments that are attached to the lens. And your lens will change shape depending on whether you're looking far away or close up. So that process of changing your depth of, or your position of focus from far away to close up is accommodation. And my goodness, I would be really surprised if you don't have that on the quiz or on the test. Okay? Accommodation. And what's the most important part of the eye that's responsible for accommodation is this? Well, you know what? That changes the shape of the lens. I would say lens. It's a lens. And as you get older, that lens just doesn't like to change shape anymore. It gets stiff. So it stiffens up, so you lose your near point accommodation. And there's something else that happens as you get older, too. Right? Not only does it get stiff, but it takes longer for it to change shape. So right now, if we look at our fingertips, all right, concentrate on your and then look at the back of the room, how long does it take for you to switch from one to the other? Yeah, pretty fast. Certainly less than a second, maybe half a second, something like that. As you get older, when you do that, guess what happens? If you look at your fingertips and then look to the back of the room, it takes longer, maybe 2 seconds to do that, all right, because the lens is real stiff. Because nothing in the lens after you're born changes. And as it gets older, it does change color. And it can become opaque, and when it becomes opaque, we call that a cataract. Okay, and that's just a natural effect of aging. And we, all of us in here probably have cataracts to some degree already. And there's one thing that produces cataracts more than anything else, because I don't see any melanin anywhere around here in the lens, and that's sunlight. So sunlight, just natural sunlight, produces cataracts, and by the time you get into your 50s and 60s, you're going to have cataracts to some degree or another. And if you spend a lot of time outside or on the water or ocean and you get a lot of sun in your eyes, then you'll get it a lot sooner. You can see some. It would be, you can see detail and things like that, but it'll be like looking through a fog. So it's kind of disturbing. It's really hard to... Oh, okay. That is a little weird. Did she get them removed? Grayish. Yeah, they look grayish. They get more and more gray all the time. Okay. So I think that is the eye, except for one last detail, and that is the photoreceptor cells. And what layer are the photoreceptor cells in? The photoreceptor cells are in the deepest layer, the retina. Okay, and you have two different kinds. So here's the retina. You got photoreceptor, you got rods and cones. And rod cells, they kind of look like rods, like little cylinders. They're good for dim light. So you can see, even in dim light with them, they're sensitive to low light conditions. But the trade-off is, you can only see black and white. You can't see color with the rod cells. And then the other kind of cells you got are what we call cone cells. Cone cells need bright light, but the good thing there is, with bright light, you can see color. So if we were to dim the lights in here, everything would kind of turn to gray, and you wouldn't see any color, but you could still see the shapes of objects. And as we bring the lights up, you start to perceive color and things like that due to the cone cells. And what layer are rods and cones in? They're the retina right here. Right. Okay. You ever see anybody driving down? Let's talk about accommodation again. Accommodation is what? Changing your position of focus from far away to close up. Ever see anybody driving down the freeway like 40 miles an hour? What kind of people are those? Yes. Okay. And why is that? Well, because they have a hard time accommodating because their lens just takes so long to shift their focus from their dashboard to looking down the freeway. So if you're probably in your 70s or so and you're still game enough to drive on the freeways, all right, I don't know if I will be or not. Maybe next week I won't be even, I'm not sure. Okay, I mean, that's not because I'm old, because it's kind of brutal out there depending on circumstances. All right, so if someone is driving really slow on the freeway, all right, usually it's an elderly person. Why? Because what are they thinking about when they're driving down the freeway? Speed limit. I don't want to get a ticket because I'll lose my license. I don't want to speed. So if you're concerned about speeding, where should you look? Your dashboard, at your speedometer, right? So you're looking at your speedometer and you see, oh, I'm going 40 miles an hour. Ah, good, I'm not speeding. All right, so you're happy. But then you go, ah, I'm worried about something else. Yeah, am I going to hit anybody? Or where is my exit? I don't want to miss my exit because then I have to drive on the freeway more. So You look up from your dashboard, the speedometer down the freeway to see your exit, and what do you see? Nothing, because your lens is real stiff. It's going to take you a while to accommodate. So 1001, 1002, you know, the traffic is going all around you like that. And you look down and you see your exit. And you go, ah, right, I haven't missed my exit. Thank God. Okay, and then you're happy for a couple seconds. And then what are you worried about? Oh, am I speeding? So then you look down at your dashboard again, right? And what do you see? Nothing, right? Because your eye has to accommodate. So 1001, 1002, and then you can see your dashboard again. In the meantime, you know, things are going, and you're worried about missing your exit again. So you go back and forth, looking down there, not seeing anything, looking at your dashboard, not seeing anything. All right? Right? And yeah, and your blinker's still on, and maybe your windshield wiper blades are going. You know, who knows? But anyway, I just want to say that when you're driving on the freeway and you see somebody driving slow like that, you should be really kind to those viejitos out there, because they just can't see very well, right? When they change their depth of focus. Yeah, just get out of their way. Just get out of their way. Don't be mean to them. Okay, so that's accommodation with the lens. The lens has to change shape to do that. I think we're almost done. We're almost done, but not quite. We got to talk about hearing. Okay, hearing involves your ear, and you got to. And this could be an exam figure too. So I'm glad we had time to talk about this. Okay, so here's your ear with some additional things drawn on it. Probably I'll erase some of these additional things. Okay, so here's your
oracle.
Your oracle. That's your earlobe. I was going to say earlobe, but your oracle, your external ear. Here's a hole in your temporal bone that allows sound pressure to enter your skull. So from here to here, this is your external ear. And so we call this the external auditory meatus. That's just a hole going into your head to allow sound pressure. And if you look inside your ear, you're going to see a membrane. That's the tympanic membrane. And the tympanic membrane is going to vibrate back and forth when sound pressure enters your ear. That's going to vibrate it back and forth. All right, so between your tympanic membrane and this thing right here, which is what we call the cochlea, this is your middle ear. And in the middle ear, you got some bones. And we do call those ossicles. And anytime you hear osteo or osti, you should think of bone. All right, and these bones, actually I got all three of them right between my fingers right here. And you know what? If you really knew the size of those bones, you would believe me. Because those bones are really teeny, teeny, tiny bones. They're the smallest bones in your body. So I could have all three and you couldn't even tell. So you got the malleus, the incus, and stapes. And the stapes, can you see it kind of looks like a stirrup on a saddle that you use for horseback riding? So they're named after kind of how they look. And so when sound enters your ear, it vibrates the tympanic membrane, and the tympanic membrane is hooked up to the ear ossicles that vibrate back and forth, and the stapes right here is hooked up to another membrane that allows the sound to get into the cochlea. So this is the inner part of the ear that is responsible for hearing. So we got external ear, the middle ear, and then the inner ear starting right here with this thing, which is what we call the oval window. Because you can see the oval nature of the stapes. And then that pressurizes fluid inside the cochlea. So you have this pressure inside the cochlea, and that gives you the sense of sound from the cochlea. Okay, so appreciate external, middle, and inner ear right here. Now, how do these things work? See if I have a cochlea. All right, here's inside your cochlea. You've got this thing that kind of looks like a snail, but it's just a flat sheet that's been rolled up so that it fits inside your head. All right, so sound gets in, so it rolls into this chamber right over here, and then it goes across the cochlear duct into this chamber before it leaves your ear. And when it goes across this structure right here, which is what we call the organ of Corti, it vibrates this tectorial membrane back and forth, right? Because sound pressure is a vibration. It's just a mechanical wave. Attached to this tectorial membrane are these hair cells. And can you see these little projections coming off of a hair cell? That's why they're called hair cells. And when these little hairs, you don't have to know what they're called, when they vibrate back and forth, they open up an ion channel and it depolarizes the cell, setting up an action potential that goes to the brain, and then you perceive the sensation of vibration here as sound. Okay, so the hair cell is responsible for doing that, and the hair cells are found in the organ of Corti, inside the cochlea. So you got hair cells, organ of Corti, inside the cochlea, and whenever you vibrate them back and forth, it sends sound information to your brain. So that's pretty much how hearing works. All right, so the cochlea contains the organ of Corti, and it's the hair cells that are responsible for producing that. Now, in balance, that's also an important function of your inner ear. There are two kinds of balance that you have: static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Static equilibrium is from the vestibule. Let's see where that vestibule is. Okay. This part right here is the vestibule. And again, it's a bony part of the inner ear, just like the cochlea is a bony part of the inner ear. So this is for static equilibrium. And then these semicircular canals, again, made out of bone, these are for kinetic equilibrium. Let's look inside one of these things. Let's look inside the vestibule for static equilibrium. You have a bunch of these hair cells again, and these hair cells send up these projections. Okay, it's kind of like a little gelatinous material, and on top of that gelatin, we have these otoliths. These are just crystals of calcium, and they're kind of heavy. So when you're standing upright, the crystals are just pressing down on these hair cells, and they're not deforming. But as soon as you tip your head forward, look what happens. These crystals are being pulled down by the force of gravity, and when they pull down, look what happens to these projections coming off the hair cells. They bend. Right? And when they bend, that causes depolarization in these cells, which sends an action potential to your brain that gives you the sense of what position your head is in. So even with your eyes closed, you can tell if your head is pointing forward and down or back or to the side or whatever. Okay, so that's static equilibrium due to the macula inside the vestibule. And you got two of those. Then the last sense, right, is what we call kinetic equilibrium. These are due to the semicircular canals, and they contain an organ called the crista ampullaris. Here's what the crista ampullaris looks like. So again, there are hair cells with these projections coming off hair cells, and there's this big gelatinous mass right here. And this gelatinous mass, when you move your head, or especially when you rotate, there's fluid inside the semicircular canal that will push on the cupula back and forth one way or the other. And when it pushes on the cupula, it bends these hair cells, and it causes a depolarization in these hair cells, which sends what? Action potentials to the brain to give you the sense of acceleration in one direction or the other. And you have three of these semicircular canals. Can you picture where those three were? Let's see. Here. Here they are. You have three semicircular canals, and what can you tell me about the arrangement of those semicircular canals? Are they all parallel to each other? You know, they're all perpendicular to each other. So there's one like this, and then there's one like this, and then which way is the third one? Show me. Yeah, like that. Okay? It's like the Macarena. Okay, three different orientations. So you can tell if you're going to be moving in an anterior or posterior direction, in a right-left direction, or what? In a up-down direction because of those three planes. You can accept, huh? Yeah, and if you're going to do anywhere in between like this, well, then it's going to be a combination of any of those three planes that will tell you what direction that you're moving in. Okay, so what organ do you have in the cochlea, in the vestibule, or actually the cell? What is the name of the cell that you have both in the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals that tells your brain something about hearing, something about position, and something about acceleration? What are the name of those cells? You know what? That's strange. That's why I'm asking. It's really strange. It's that same cell. It's called a hair cell. So all those senses that you have are vastly different, right? But what is the cell that gives your brain that information? Okay, those are the hair cells right there. All right, so that's, I think, it for senses. Let's see, what about some of these study questions? Do you want to go over any of these study questions? Okay, general special senses. You got the list on your handout. And what's the distinction between general and special? Well, if it's all over your body, if you have receptors all over your body, that's just general. But if you have receptor organs in just one or two places, that makes it a special sense. Okay, so be able to classify senses as either being general or special, like temperature is what? General. Pain, general. You get that all over. What about vision?
Special.
Proprioception. That's a tricky one. You have proprioception all over your body, so that's a general one, even though it sounds special. What about hearing?
Special.
Taste. Special. Olfaction is special. Static and kinetic equilibrium only from your inner ear. That's special as well. Okay. What is olfaction? That's smell. And what does it sense? It senses odorant molecules or odors. You could just say odors. What cranial nerve transmits olfactory sensory signals? Cranial nerve number one. Okay, and what lobe do they go to? I don't know, I forget what it says in the notes. What does it say? Temporal. Okay, what are the four primary taste sensations? You got sweet, bitter, sour,
salt.
Oh, very important, salt, yeah. Okay, and know how they're arranged on the tongue? I don't think I asked that question anymore, how they're arranged on the tongue, but you should know the four primary taste sensations. What are the accessory structures associated with vision?
Eyelashes,
eyebrows, lacrimal gland, eyelids. Yeah, the conjunctiva, all those extrinsic eye muscles for moving your eyeball around. What are the layers of the eye? Starting from the external one, the superficial, you got sclera, you got the choroid, and then the retina. Sclera, choroid, retina. What layer contains blood vessels? That would be the choroid. Choroid contains blood vessels. What layer contains photoreceptor cells? The retina contains photoreceptor cells. What are the two kinds of photoreceptor cells? You got rods and cones. And where are they located? The cones are in the very center. The rods are in the periphery. So if you want to double check your notes, that should be in there. What are the two humors of the eye? Vitreous humor and aqueous humor. Where is the aqueous humor? Anterior part, where is the vitreous humor? Posterior chamber cavity. Oh, I didn't go over this. What two structures of the eye work together to focus light on the retina? You know what? I want to go over that. I guess I need to go over that. I got to turn the light on. Okay. The lens certainly focuses light on the retina, but what else has the shape of a lens? Look at the cornea right here. What does it kind of look like? It's curved. It's just curved, just like a lens is curved. So actually, it's the cornea and the lens working together to focus light on the retina. Those are the two most important things that focus light on the retina. It's the cornea as well as the lens. And if anybody's ever had LASIK procedure, guess what? They kind of know that, because with LASIK procedure, the laser just reshapes the cornea to give you perfect vision, like almost instantaneously, just in a matter of seconds. So when you get a LASIK procedure, you're not doing surgery on anything deep in the eye, like the lens. It's just a very superficial thing, which means what? It's very easy to get to. So it's the cornea and the lens. Okay. Number nine. I don't know if I can finish. What muscle, ligament, and optical component of eye function in accommodation? It's the ciliary muscle, the suspensory ligament, and the lens for accommodation. So you got the ciliary muscle or ciliary body, the suspensory ligament, and then the lens work for accommodation. Okay, what are the three divisions of the ear? And what special senses are they involved in? What are they? You got external, you got middle, and internal. Those are the three. And the external is good for what? Hearing. The external is good for hearing. And the middle is good for hearing. And the inner ear is good for hearing. But those other two senses, static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium, it's only the inner ear. Equilibrium doesn't need the middle part or the external ear, because they don't need, it doesn't need to hear anything. It just needs motion. Okay. What are the auditory ossicles? They're those little, what are they? They're those little bones in your middle ear. Auditory ossicles are the little bones. The tympanic membrane, where's that located? That's right at the end of the external ear, right at the end of the external auditory meatus. So when you look inside somebody's ear, you can see that tympanic membrane right there. And the oval and round window are on the cochlea. They're right between the middle ear and the internal ear. Here's a good question. I'm sure this question's on the test. Next one. What's the name of the organ responsible for hearing? The cochlea is the bony labyrinth, but the organ is the organ of Corti. Organ of Corti. And what's the bony labyrinth it's located in? Now, that's the cochlea. The bony labyrinth is the cochlea. And here's an easy one. Name the cell primarily responsible for transducing sound into nerve signals. It's a hair cell. It's weird, but it's true. It's that hair cell. Hair cell. All right, two more quick questions. What's the name of the organ responsible for static equilibrium? That's the macula. You got two of them. You got two macula, so we call those both together maculae. Right? And in what bony labyrinth is it located? The vestibule. Name the cell primarily responsible for transducing body position into nerve signals. It's weird. It's that hair cell. Hair cell again. Hair cell. And then the last question, what's the name of the organ responsible for kinetic equilibrium? It's not the organ of Corti, not the maculae, it's the crista ampullaris. Two words, crista ampullaris. And what bony labyrinth is the crista ampullaris? You got three of them. they're in this three semicircular canals. And lastly, name the cell primarily responsible for transducing kinetic motion into nerve signals. That's that hair cell again. So that could be a trick question. Hair cell, hair cell, hair cell. For hearing and equilibrium. All right, so get out a pencil. When you turn your quiz in, I'll give you the take home. If I brought it. I'm sure I did. Okay, so take one and pass it down. I was wondering what happened.